Today's Taisho will be on Case 30 in the Mumonkan. Case 30 is entitled, Basho's This Very Mind is the Buddha. Dai Bai asked Basho, what is the Buddha? Basho answered, this very mind is the Buddha. Mumon's comment, if you directly grasp Basho's meaning, you wear the Buddha's clothes, eat the Buddha's food, speak the Buddha's words, do the Buddha's deeds. That is, you are the Buddha himself. Alas, Dai Bai misled not a few people into taking the mark on the scale for the weight itself. How could he realize that even mentioning the word Buddha should make us rinse out our mouths for 3 days? If a word of understanding hears anyone say, this very mind is the Buddha, he will cover his ears and rush away. Mumon's verse. The blue sky and bright day. No more searching around. What is Buddha, you ask? With loot in your pocket, you declare yourself innocent. I'm very glad that so many people came here to practice Zen this morning. I don't know about your neighborhood, but my neighborhood looks like a war zone. There were a tremendous number of trees that went down during the storm where I live in Plainfield. And we just got our electricity turned on yesterday. I had a call on my phone from my wife at home around 11:15, and she said the power is on. It was such a lovely thing. So I hope you're in a similar circumstance. I hope you have your electricity, and I hope you are safe and warm in your homes. And I'm very glad you came to sit this morning, practice Zen. This is quite a famous koan. Basho's This Very Mind is the Buddha. Dai Bai asked Basho, what is Buddha? Basho said, this very mind is the Buddha. I actually like to go camping quite a bit. And I enjoy hiking in the mountains, and I consider it a really good time to stay in a tent and hike maybe 10 miles a day and not take a bath for 7 days, basically, and come out of the woods smelling like smoke and sweat. And I actually enjoy that quite a bit. And when I go camping, of course, I go to bed when I run out of light, and I get up with the dawn so that I can see what I'm doing, and usually I make a fire, I sleep on the ground. Usually I have some kind of a pad, and I sleep in a sleeping bag, and sometimes it's cold, and I shiver at night, and I get up in the morning and roll up my bag, and it's freezing cold. Ooh, you know. And I call that a good time. And I even pay, you know, money to do that. You know, like, buy an airline ticket to someplace out west and stay in a motel and go to a lot of trouble and expense to have that kind of an experience. It was like that when the power went down for a little while, you know. So like, we lost power at my house on Monday night at around 6. And I was online, of course, and I was, using the internet. And the power went down, and then, my wife and I, we thought, well, we'll be fine. You know, we have candles. We got out our candles. We had a big pile of firewood in the back. So we started a fire in the fireplace, and we had candles all around, and it was actually quite beautiful, you know. And so, the first night was a real triumph. You know, we managed to make, we had plenty of candles, we had plenty of wood. When we went to bed, it was a little bit cold, but actually Monday night wasn't so cold. So, you know, it seemed like we could handle this. And then, you know, then there was Tuesday night. Same thing. We got out the candles, made the fire. One of our neighbors is an elderly gentleman who came over to our house. His name is Leonard. He came over at one point in the week, and Kriti and Imtiaz came over just to see if we were safe. It was very wonderful and thoughtful thing to do. They drove all the way out to Plainfield just to see if Barbara and I were okay. Day one, we did okay. Day two, I think Imtiaz and Kriti came out, and we all sat by the fire and had a nice time, had tea. Day three, I think Leonard came over, and we made him some tea. And he's quite an interesting guy. He's Jamaican, and he has a beautiful accent. And he was telling us all about jazz music and so on, and that was wonderful. And then Thursday, and then Friday, and then Saturday, and then Sunday, and then we started the next week, you know. After a while, I began to find this no longer exciting and amusing. I began to find it a little depressing, you know. So when I would drive home through the streets, which are filled with broken trees and everything, the whole street would be dark. And I would get up to my dark house, and it was colder later on. And I would get out of my car and go into the dark house, and I began to feel that this was not any fun anymore. That this was sort of depressing. It's like, when is the power going to be on? And nothing had really changed except my state of mind, you know. But I would actually feel, thinking about going home, I'd feel this great reluctance, this great great weight on my shoulders, like going home was a kind of a burden. And my wife also independently felt this way. You know, I think on Thursday, she went out and tried to find a motel to stay in. She had this idea, finally. We were running out of firewood. We had no more candles. She thought, maybe we'll just stay in a motel. And, of course, this was not an original idea. Everybody in the state of New Jersey had decided to stay in a motel. And so she spent the whole day going from motel to motel, trying to get a room. And, of course, there were no rooms. And when I went to work on Friday morning, there was a program on NPR. It was a local report on NPR about how there were no hotels in New Jersey. And they interviewed a guy who was a big, tough, they said he was a bouncer in a bar. And they said he had been stabbed 5 times. And he had a scar across his face where somebody had slashed his face with a broken bottle. And he was almost crying. He said, my house is freezing. I can't go home. You know, there's water coming through the roof. He had some flooding, and he said, you know, I just want to stay in a hotel room, you know, and there were no hotels. So, Barbara, too, had this feeling. It was like going home in the dark, you know, such an unwelcoming experience, you know. And what had been fun became, it was almost like claustrophobic, going into this very cold place. You know, in Seattle, we used to sit at Genki, before we had a place in the city, we used to sit in a little house up on a mountain. It was called Kugeon. That was where Genki Roshi lived for a while. And we would all get in John Sunston's Volkswagen bus and drive down from the university district to South Seattle, where Genki Roshi lived. And we'd get there at like 4:30 in the morning, and we would all come into the Zendo with our coats on. And Genki Roshi would open the windows wide every morning. You know, every once in a while I would come in, I would sit down, and I would realize he hadn't opened the windows. And it was so cold outside, I'd think, maybe he'll forget today, you know. And then he would get up and open them up, you know. And so we were sitting in the cold and the dark, day after day. And I almost would, like, tremble thinking about it sometime, you know. I'd be sitting there all bundled up, trying to stay warm in the dark and the cold. And the house kind of reminded me of that, you know, going into this cold, dark house. You know, we'd build a fire, we'd sit by the fire. When you have to go upstairs, you have to leave the warm fire and go upstairs. And it's freezing cold upstairs, you know. So, you know, what had seemed like fun, what had seemed like camping, became this very negative experience. And, you know, I have to say that, you know, as usual, I tried to do Zazen. And I got up one morning and was feeling, you know, like enough is enough already. You know, where's the power? And I sat down and I had a really beautiful sit in the cold and the dark. And I've had many, many beautiful sits in the cold and the dark. And it made me feel so much better, you know, so much better. You know, I got up and I took a shower and I went to work and I didn't feel so trapped in my situation, you know, which really wasn't a terrible situation at all. You know, our house was okay and so on. But sometimes it doesn't take much to make us feel like there's no way out. You know, that we're trapped, there's no way out, there's nothing we can do. And, you know, I sat and I had a wonderful sit. And I got up and I went to work and I felt like $1 million. I felt really wonderful, you know. So, you know, there is this element to life where how we interact with the world has to do with our own memories and our own expectations about how things should be. You know, every night I would sort of torture myself thinking, will the lights be on? And I could visualize my house with the lights coming through the window, the light flowing, the soft, warm light throwing, you know. And I would get to this dark house, and it was like a little game I would play with myself to make myself a little sad about going into my cold, dark house. And, you know, when I did some Zazen, it really allowed me to feel better. And, you know, the question is, what is it about Zazen that does this? You know, how can Zazen do this? Because I have to tell you, you know, this isn't the only time in my life that I've been down, you know. You know, felt that feeling of there's nothing I can do, I'm boxed in, you know, and so on and so on. And, you know, I think Zazen is really quite remarkable. There are some things Zazen will not do. You know, there's some things Zazen will not do. So, you know, yesterday I was working with a co-worker of mine who is somebody I regard very, very highly. And I really wanted to connect with this person in a way that would leave this person feeling good. You know, this is a co-worker of mine. Somebody I think of really have enormous respect and real affection for, real love for. And so I was talking to this person in my office, and I was trying to help them deal with a problem. And I said exactly the wrong thing. I said something that hurt them very much. And I thought, after it was over, I thought, oh, why did I say that? Now, I'm really telling you the truth that Zazen will not prevent you from making those kinds of mistakes. No matter, it may be true, maybe there are people who have been doing a lot of Zazen who are so intuitive they never make that kind of mistake. But I haven't gotten to that point yet. And so, you know, it's quite possible to say something to somebody and hurt their feelings and not mean to have hurt their feelings. But Zazen can still be very helpful, even if it doesn't make you omniscient or perfectly intuitive, because it really does allow you to cut through a great deal of negativity. Really cut through negativity. I was feeling some negativity in my house the last 2 weeks with no power. And I was sort of enjoying the negativity, I guess, on some level. But it was deeply felt, you know. House means a lot to us, right? A home means a lot to us. Going into a place that's warm and sheltering is very important. And being in a place that's cold and dark could be a problem. For some people it's not a problem, but for me it was a problem. And sitting, doing Zazen, really helped me. And, you know, after I had this experience yesterday with this person I work with, who I really care about so deeply, and whom I obviously hurt quite a bit, you know, I was troubled by that all day, actually. And even last night, when I tried to sleep, I thought about it, you know, during the night, and I woke up and I couldn't sleep. And it was one of those nights where you think, why did I say that? I know I caused that person a lot of pain. That person is probably waking up right now, can't sleep either, you know, that kind of thing. And so when I came in to do when I came in this morning, you know, sat down on the cushion, I really threw myself into my sitting, and began to feel a little better after a couple hours of Zazen. You know, began to feel like a little better. You know, there's something about meditation practice which is really quite precious, and which I worry people can't really won't always appreciate, you know. Zen sitting doesn't make you omniscient. It doesn't make you able to read minds. It doesn't even give you an ability to read your own mind sometimes very well. But there's something about it that's really quite liberating and quite special. You know, I have had many occasions in my life where I've sat down on the cushion and I've been really in distress, like emotional distress. Either because I have been having trouble at work, or I've been having trouble in personal relationships, and so on. And, you know, the mind in that condition just goes over and over the events that have caused this distress. So, you know, you are sitting in your cold, dark house thinking, this is a cold, dark house, this is a cold, dark house, if only the lights were on, etc., etc. And you go over and over that. You know, and you imagine when you go in the kitchen used to be warm, now the kitchen's freezing cold. So you know, you get caught in these loops, in these feedback loops, and it's hard to break out of them. And the same thing with this incident that happened yesterday, that, you know, where I had meant to say something positive and had wound up hurting somebody's feelings. You know, I just sort of replayed that in my head all night, thinking, why wasn't I more sensitive? Why didn't I think that through, you know? So you sit down on the cushion and you know, you can also on the cushion replay all this stuff in your head. But if you're meditating properly, you know, you bring the mind back to the breath, back to the breath, back to the breath. And little by little, you begin just a little bit to be present in with the moment. It might, whatever the moment happens to be, but you're bringing your mind back to the present moment, to the here and now. And it's not always easy to do this. It's not always easy to do this because, you know, we have these fears and attachments. We have our own psychological baggage. Sometimes we're really powerfully gripped by our emotions. It's hard to break out of them. But you know, if you are practicing Zazen, you focus on your breath, you focus on your breath, you focus on your breath, little by little, little by little, you know, you begin to be in the moment. It may take you 2 hours, but eventually, you know, your mind is more fully in the moment. And when your mind is more fully in the moment, you will probably notice that your pain, or I should say your suffering, it goes away. Even if you're feeling like intense distress, if you can bring your mind back to the moment, it's extremely helpful. You know, it really, you'll notice that when you're fully present in the moment, that distress is not present. You know, as soon as you return the mind to the loop, you know, the distress returns. But in the moment, there's this beautiful, beautiful stillness and presentness that is extraordinarily easy to overlook, but is profoundly liberating. You know, this week on NPR, I was listening to NPR in my car. Actually, I was listening to the BBC. And one program, I don't remember which day it was, featured a book on silence. There was a new book that's come out on silence. And you know, it was one of the last installments on that hour of the BBC, which they broadcast the BBC program at 9 o'clock, and at just about 10 of 10. They played this little segment on this book on silence, and they interviewed this man. And I just thought, oh, you know, silence. I've been there, done that. You know. And he was absolutely fascinating, because he said that he had been a military officer. And he had been a typical sort of military officer, drilling and grilling his soldiers and making sure they were, you know, ship shape and so on and so on. And he was sort of a bossy guy, you know, sort of a very fastidious, tough man, a drill sergeant type personality. And he was off duty, and he was with a friend of his. And the friend said to him, "Listen, would you like to hear this? He said, "Would you like to hear the voice of God?" And he took his friend out to like this canyon or this area that was absolutely still, and there was absolutely no sound. And he just left him there to sit there with that silence. I can't remember where they were. I can't remember where they were stationed. But this was some time ago. And this drill sergeant sat there in this silence. And he said it was one of the most extraordinary experiences he ever had. And he said he realized, after spending like, I don't know how long, in this silence, he came back, and he said he knew that he had to write. He had treated a soldier unfairly, and he sat down and he wrote an apology to this soldier. And he said the other thing he knew immediately and intuitively was that he had gone to Oxford, and he said, when I went to Oxford, he said, I became a terrible, terrible snob. And he said, I wrote a letter of apology to my parents for being such a little snob and treating them so badly. And I thought that story was just extraordinary, you know, because, you know, normally we fill up our lives with distractions, including ideas, you know. And we're so distracted, and more, right, by the internet and phones and so on, iPads. You know, he went out into this canyon somewhere and sat in this silence. And he said, for the first time, he said, I heard my inner voice my inner voice. And he said, I knew immediately what I had to do. It was like this aspect of his life experience that he had sort of covered over was right there for him to see. And he came out, and the first thing he did was, I've done an injustice to somebody, and I have to set it right. And the second thing he did was to apologize to his parents for making them feel lousy about not having gone to Oxford. He said that was the beginning of his journey into silence, his experience of silence. And I had to say, I thought this was one of the most perceptive interviews I've ever heard on the BBC, you know. And in fact, the woman who presented the program actually said, she was so moved by this little vignette that she said, when the show is over, I'm just going to go somewhere and sit in silence for a while. And she wasn't kidding. I think she really, you know, we do that too in Zazen. You know, we sit down, we watch the breath, and, you know, at some point, we're just here in the moment. And there is a kind of silence, right? We're not imposing anything on the moment. We're just present with the moment without any embellishment or any adornment. And when we're in that empty state, you know, sometimes it becomes possible to hear our inner voice, you know, to hear our inner voice. And to see what's, you know, we see our distress, which we might not have allowed ourselves to see. We see our fear, we see our anger, we see our envy, and so on. And when we come back to the moment again and again, you know, it begins to loosen its grip over us, you know, and we can, little by little, we're no longer dominated by these negative emotions, negative responses. We can be open and trusting again with life. And I think this is quite remarkable, you know, that we have this capacity to do this, to sit down and be still and be silent, and encounter ourselves in a way that we normally don't allow ourselves to do. You know, it worries me very much that that our culture is losing touch with this extraordinary way of living. You know, many, many years ago, I went backpacking with my friend Larry Sullivan in, I think it was Canyonlands in Utah. And at that time, there were very few roads, and there were no buildings at all. There was just there was a campground, and a truck that had water water barrels on the back for hikers. And we went hiking out there in that extraordinary country. And I remember going into these canyons, you know, like in this story on the BBC, where there was absolutely, it seemed there was absolutely no sound, you know. At the time, it made me tremendously uncomfortable. You know, my instinct was to speak, you know, talk. And, you know, so I started talking to Larry about the silence. And I was trying to fill it up. I think because maybe, you know, that it made me nervous. I think it made me somewhat nervous. Maybe there was something inside myself I didn't want to encounter, you know. But I remember having a very deep feeling there. And later on, just going out into the desert, where it was, again, very silent. And you know, at that time, I wasn't particularly religious, you know, but I actually prayed, you know, to be a better person. That really happened. And, you know, I didn't really know what I was praying to, but I really prayed to be a better person, better human being. And I think there was something about that silence that made me respond in that way, You know, I think, you know, in Buddhism we have this idea of bodhicitta, that inside the human being there is this you could say, heart of compassion or heart of loving kindness. And bodhicitta is this inherent compassion, this inherent loving nature. And, you know, they say that when you have begun to practice meditation, at some point you awaken bodhicitta, bodhicitta. This is like Buddha heart, Buddha heart. And I think that when I went out into the desert and prayed to be a better person, you know, basically I was really feeling like the awakening of Buddha heart in this this amazing silence, you know. And it worries me now that people have so few opportunities to be in that silence. You know, I have become myself an internet addict. I have to confess, I'm truly addicted to the internet. I get up in the morning and I do zazen, and then after I finish my zazen, I go in and I sit down at the computer. And I drink a cup of coffee and I start surfing the net. And in some ways I think I undo all the good of the sitting. Because, you know, I start filling my mind with all of this information, you know, all, just like a flood of information. And afterwards I actually feel a little bit, it's like I feel a little bit like a kid who's eaten too much candy, you know. It's like, you know, one piece of candy is good, 10 pieces of candy makes you want to throw up, you know. So I think we are sort of in an information age where we get too much candy, you know. You know, it's not necessarily good for us to be awash in a sea of information. And this, during these 2 weeks when I had no power, or these 12 days when I had no power, I couldn't get up and get off the cushion and sit down and surf the net. I got off the cushion and basically I went to work, or I went for a walk, you know, that kind of thing. And I think I felt much better throughout the day. I really do think I have become addicted to the internet, and I'm hoping that maybe I could be a little bit more controlled. Maybe after I sit in the morning I won't read the newspapers. I'm going to try that. I think my resolution will last for at least 2 or 3 days. But it would be good if that would actually happen, I have the feeling. Because I do feel that being awash in all this information keeps us from noticing that kind of silence that's really underneath all of this, you know. And it was very much present there when the internet was out. There was just nothing to do in the morning other than sit, you know. And after I sat, there's nothing to do except be here in this cold room. But actually, when I had finished sitting, you know, I was sort of present with it, and it wasn't terrible at all. I have been reading this man who's an Italian. His name is Berardi. He's an Italian philosopher, and I think he's really fascinating. He has said that actually the internet has had a very negative effect on our emotional life. I mean, you know, I know people who love the internet. Whenever I say something in Taisho, I hope you will always take it with a big grain of salt, you know. The other day I was reading a book by a very famous Tibetan teacher. His name was Chogyam Trungpa. And in the book he said, if you stop doing meditation, you will turn into a much worse person. And when I read that, I actually was outraged. Because I'd like you to know that if you stop doing zazen, you won't turn into a much worse person at all. And you could do zazen and actually be a not very nice person too, believe it or not. So I feel that Chogyam Trungpa was actually sort of like blackmailing his students into doing zazen, you know, doing meditation. There are many really wonderful people who don't do meditation. And there, I've known some people who do meditation who aren't so wonderful. So my point is that when you read Trungpa, please read him with a grain of salt. And when you listen to me also, you should also always have a big grain of salt in your pocket. Okay. It seems to me that this man Berardi might be right, you know. He says that we have so much information all the time that it's beyond our power to assimilate. And he said people begin to feel that they're helpless in these flows of information. Now, you know, that might seem like an overstatement, but maybe on a subtle psychological level it's actually true, you know, that there's so much information out there that we don't really have a chance to sort of internalize it, you know. Now, when I was in high school, I used to like to read novels. And I remember reading Hemingway's and The Sun Also Rises. And I read it like 3 times, and I'm a very slow reader. So, you know, I would just lie down on the bed, and I would read, and I would read slowly, and I would sort of mull it over. And I'd get up after a few hours of reading and walk around, and I'd come back and read some more. It was very leisurely, and I had a lot of time to sort of like digest the information. And it stayed with me. I can remember very small details in that book, even now. And I can remember, you know, sort of like emotions, feeling certain emotions when I read the book. And the book became part of my life, you know. One of the heroes in there likes to camp out and likes to, you know, hike in the mountains, and maybe he was one of the reasons I began to do hiking, you know, reading about Hemingway's hero going up in the mountains. So the book was something I had a chance to take in very slowly, and it really began to become part of me in a way that made me feel like my life fit together in this coherent way. And I don't think we internalize the internet the same way. I think it just, this information flows over us. Sometimes we're just sort of feeling like we're sort of noticing things as they rush by. And anyway, Berardi says that, you know, this creates it actually creates a kind of panic, he says, that we all feel a little bit panicky because there's so much information out there. And he says this information panic has made a lot of people depressed. You know, this could be complete baloney. You know, philosophers can get away with murder. But he doesn't have any evidence to support his claims. But when I read this, I thought, you know, this makes a lot of sense to me, you know, that we're so awash in information. And maybe there is a lot of depression because people just feel that they can't make sense of things, you know, on a deeper level. And I think that that's another aspect of meditation practice that's quite important. You know, when things happen to us, we don't really know what to do with them, you know. If you go to work and somebody says, you know, your boss comes in and says, you didn't do a good job, you know, at the time that might not seem like much. Maybe the boss makes a joke out of it. It just says, you know, this didn't turn out very well, did it? And then, you know, you laugh with him and you're working on something else. But as you're driving home in your car, you think about what he said, you know, and it begins to be present, you know, for you. And you might not be able to free yourself from it. You just keep coming back to this loop. You know, there's a process of having something happen and then gradually internalizing it and, you know, becoming aware of how we feel about it and then either storing it away or getting obsessed in our loops or sitting with our discomfort until it releases us, you know. So you know, we really need time. You know, I love this phrase that psychologists use, that therapists use. They say processing. I have fallen in love with that word, you know. My wife sometimes says to me, Barbara sometimes says things to me, and she's waiting for my response, and now I can say, I'm processing, I'm still processing. And I am, I'm still processing. I'm trying to figure out what this means emotionally, what this means on a deeper level. And that's a fair thing to say. I'm still processing. I don't know what to make of this yet, you know. And I think I'm a slow processor, you know. I don't really feel things right away. It takes me a while for them to soak into my bones, and then I suddenly realize, oh, that was a mistake, or, oh, that was really nice, you know. So there's a bit of a delay between the event and my response, you know. And I think Zazen helps us to get in touch with that process, you know, where you can begin to feel, you can begin to realize how things are taking a place in your life, how things are becoming a part of your emotional life. And so, you know, sometimes things happen and we say, you know, something might happen at work. You say, that doesn't bother me. That doesn't bother me. But maybe it does bother you. You know, you sit down on the cushion and you realize, oh, this really bothers me, you know. What we want to do is push it away and just not make it go away. But a lot of meditation practice is finding that stable samadhi state, and then, you know, when you encounter this thing that is causing you discomfort or pain, gradually sitting with it until it begins to dissipate. You know. And the result is, you know, this great feeling of freedom, great feeling of freedom. You know, when Basho says, what is the Buddha? Basho answered, this very mind is the Buddha. This very mind is the Buddha. You know, what does that really mean? I think Basho is saying that, you know, when you are in the moment, 100%, you know, you are on the path to liberation. You are on the path to liberation. It's possible to be absolutely out of touch with our feelings and our emotions, and it's possible to be caught up in them in ways that don't allow us to be to breathe freely. You know, you begin to feel that claustrophobia of being overwhelmed by information or by your emotions or by something that's happened to you, bringing the mind back to the moment, back to the moment, back to the moment is like it really liberating. Really, this is, if you haven't tried it, please try it. If you're in the worst distress emotionally, if you bring your attention back to the moment, you'd notice that the distress disappears. This is also true for physical pain. You know, if you're sitting on the cushion and you're having a lot of physical pain, it might help to open your eyes and focus on the moment. You'll notice that your pain dissipates. Your suffering dissipates. Suffering dissipates. There's a little bit of a difference between pain and suffering. You know, we all have experiences in life that are difficult and painful, but suffering is caused by not being able to work through them. Not being able to work through them. You know, Zen is really sometimes kind of brutally direct. And one of the ways Zen is brutally direct is by having people encounter pain. You know, if you do meditation at a sesshin for 9 hours a day, you're going to have pain in your legs. And it's a stark fact, right, that you can't escape from. And you might say, well, why does Zen do this? You know, why not? But I think there's great wisdom to facing up to the existence of pain. And a lot of Zen practice has that element to it, you know, sitting with physical pain. And physical pain is really very difficult to deal with. You know, you can't think it away. You can't daydream it away. Or at least I don't think you can. You know, I have done a lot of Zazen, and I've been in pain a lot of times. And I have tried every possible strategy for making it go away. And you can't sit and think, tell yourself a story. It actually makes the pain worse. You can't really evoke a beautiful memory. That doesn't work. You know, pain cuts through all of that. I mean, I think it does anyway. You know, years ago a person came into Dokusan and I said, "How's it going with the pain?" And the person said, "Oh, fine. What I do is I imagine I'm on this island," you know, and you know, it goes. I thought, "Really? It hasn't worked for me, you know." So maybe it does work. I don't know. Generally speaking, you can't imagine your pain away. You can't think it away. And it's starkly present, you know. And it causes a lot of suffering to be in pain. But, you know, if you focus on your breath and you bring your mind back to the breath in a one-pointed and direct way, I'm not going to say the pain goes away, but the suffering goes away. You know, there are... there are many stories where people have been in sesshin and they've been in mortal agony, and then they say, "You know, I just realized I should embrace my pain." And they'll say, "You know, suddenly the pain was not a problem for me." This is ordinary mind, ordinary mind. This pure presentness, you know, in the pure presentness, a suffering is no longer there. You know, the Buddhist word for pure presentness is tat-atta, tat-atta. That's pure presentness, pure this thusness. It's often translated in translations as thusness. In thusness, suffering disappears. And the Buddha himself was called the Tathagata, which means the person who dwells in pure presentness. So, Daibai asked Basho, "What is the Buddha?" Basho answered, "This very mind is the Buddha." Mumon's comment: if you directly grasp Basho's meaning, if you can bring your consciousness to the present moment in an unthinking and one-pointed way, you wear the Buddha's clothes, eat the Buddha's food, speak the Buddha's words, do the Buddha's deeds. That is, you are the Buddha himself. Alas, however, Daibai misled not a few people into taking the mark on the balance for the weight itself. How could he realize that even mentioning the word Buddha should make us rinse out our mouths for 3 days? Pure presentness is not an idea. When ideas disappear, you will find yourself in pure presentness. Buddha itself is just an idea. So he said, don't, you know, if you're sitting on the cushion trying to experience Buddha nature, or Buddha-ness, or Buddhahood, or enlightened mind, you're on the road to great suffering. The secret is to put all of your thoughts aside and just be present with the moment. So, but Daibai misled not a few people into taking the mark on the balance for the weight itself. How could he realize that even mentioning the word Buddha should make us rinse out our mouths for 3 days? If a man of understanding hears anyone say, "This very mind is the Buddha," he will cover his ears and rush away. Mumon's verse: the blue sky and bright day, no more searching around. What is Buddha, you ask? With loot in your pocket, you declare yourself innocent. This pure presentness is always there. You know, it's always reachable. It's always attainable. You know, your house could be cold and dark, you could be in great emotional distress if you sit down on the cushion and you focus on your breath and you keep bringing the mind back to the moment. You're going to enter this place where you are really fundamentally free from suffering. So if you haven't tried it yet, please try it. If you know how to do this, please enjoy it. Be thankful that this is available to us as human beings. I hardly a day goes by when I don't think that this is the most amazing thing in the world, this Zazen. And I thank you very much. I'm really honored that you all came here to practice today.